This is an iHeart podcast.
Pro Woche bis zu 50 Euro zusätzlich sparen. Mit der Netto Plus App. 10% Rabatt auf deinen Einkauf sichern. Dazu Payback-Punkte sammeln und sparen. Mach mehr Plus mit der Netto Plus App.
The Medal of Honor is the highest military decoration in the United States. Recipients have done the improbable, the unexpected, showing immense bravery and sacrifice in the name of something much bigger than themselves.
This medal is for the man who went down that day.
On Medal of Honor, Stories of Courage, you'll hear about these heroes and what their stories tell us about the nature of bravery. Listen to Medal of Honor on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Newton Group Transfer. They are here to help you if you're stuck in a timeshare. These stories from people who have these timeshares and can't get out of them, they're shocking. These timeshare companies, not all of them, but so many, they get their hooks into you and you can't give them up. You can't give them up. Or they'll do things like they charge you thousands of dollars. One girl, she got past her timeshare when her mother passed away. She gets past the timeshare, doesn't want the timeshare, doesn't use the timeshare. They tell her she can get out of it for $4,000. She has to come up with a $4,000 check. This is not right. It's unjust. And Newton Group Transfers is here to help you. If you are in a timeshare and want out or know someone who is, call 888-845-3773. That's 888-84-JESSE or go to timesharejesse.com. Newton Group Transfer. They will help you out.
This is the Jesse Kelly Show.
I want you to imagine being tied to a post in an Indian village. Your friend is tied to a post beside you. Now, your friend is not in a good spot. You see, you've been left alone up to this point. Your turn is coming. Your friend, however, well, he doesn't look very good. And he doesn't look very good because the Indians in this village have taken sharp slivers of a pine tree, and I don't mean one or two, I mean 100 of them, and they've shot them into his body, so he's full of, he looks like a pincushion, right? And you're next. And you watch as they approach the friend of yours, who looks like a pincushion, obviously in a great deal of pain. And they light all those pine slivers on fire and burn him like a torch. And you watch this. You hear this. You smell it. And you're next. Now I want you to imagine that this isn't even number one. Maybe not even number two on the most terrifying things that have ever happened to you in your life. 1783 in Scranton, Pennsylvania, a young man was born. His name was Hugh. He was, by all accounts, a very big, well-mannered, if not a little wild, young man. And he needed to branch out. He wanted to go see adventure. And don't we all have that, especially as dudes to some extent? You look at the world around you and you think to yourself, I want to see it, man. I want to touch it. I want to taste it. I want to experience life. And you, he experienced life. So he struck out on the ocean. Remember, this is a time long before Carnival Cruise Lines, this is a time of piracy. There's no GPS. The ocean, even if the pirates don't get you, is an extremely rough, dangerous place. You don't get to pull up your weather app in the middle of the Pacific and, oh, looks like we got a hurricane coming. It should be here in exactly 12 days because it's rounding the Cape of Africa. The hurricane just comes and you're dead. So Hugh makes his way from Scranton, Pennsylvania, down into the Gulf of Mexico, where he works on a ship and works his way up because this dude is intelligent and a leader and brave. And soon he is the captain of a ship in the Gulf of Mexico. Well, he's the captain of a ship until the year 1816, when he comes across a man named Jean Lafitte. Now, Jean Lafitte was part privateer, part pirate, which if you want to get down to the nitty-gritty are just two of the same thing. Privateer is just a pirate who gets hired by a country to do piracy. Now, contrary to the movies and contrary to popular belief, most pirates did not get on board the ship and make you walk the plank and kill every man, woman, and child. Don't get me wrong, they were very violent. They killed plenty of people. But pirates were always looking to make their own crews a little bigger, a little stronger. And so when you're a pirate crew and you come across young Hugh, who's the captain, clearly knows his way around a boat. The dude is clearly large. They just got done fighting with the guy and they know he knows how to handle himself. They give you a very simple choice. Well, we can cut your head off right now, or you can become a pirate with us. And he made the same decision most of us would make. You know what? The pirate life sounds like it's for me. Actually, that's going to be fine. Hugh didn't want to be there, but signed on to be a pirate. There are disputes how long he was a pirate. Some say a year, some say two. Eventually, he gets close enough to Galveston. Those of you not down in this Houston area should know this. Galveston is essentially a long strip of an island southeast of Houston. And the area, the ocean around Galveston, is extremely, extremely shallow in certain places. Hugh knew this, bailed off the boat with a friend and escaped the pirates. Woo! Life is good. He made it to the shore. Well, this is not Galveston in the year 2020. This is Galveston in the year 1818, and Texas was a very, very, very dangerous place at this time. Especially the Galveston area, because it was full of Karankawa Indians. Now, they were supposedly very brave warriors. They also ate people. One thing I found when I was redoing some reading on this last night that I think you'll enjoy as a quick side note. TexasIndians.com is where I got this. I love this part. I don't know why this just killed me, Chris. It says, quote, "One false myth is that they were cannibals. Yes, they sometimes ate the captured enemy warriors and leaders after a battle or war, but they didn't do it for food." Look, with all due respect to TexasIndians.com, that's still cannibalism. If somebody's going to cook me and eat me, is the reasoning behind it really that important? I mean, it's no big deal. They're going to eat me, but it's not for food. It's fine. So Hugh and his buddy managed to actually avoid the Karankawa Indians, and they make their way through Texas. Again, Texas is a very dangerous place because once you avoid the Karankawa Indians at this time, you have to deal with the Comanche. Now, let me step aside again briefly and let you know, the Comanche Indians were not just Indians that you got to see in the various John Wayne movies like I've seen my entire life. Comanche Indians were something unique. They mastered riding horses, very similar to the way the Mongols did. And they slaughtered everybody. They very, very, very much so competed with the United States Army for a long time in Texas. They had a massive empire, and they were a juggernaut. Those Apache Indians we all love, you know, Geronimo, the Apaches, the fierce warriors, the amazing Apaches. Do you know the reason the Apaches were over there in the New Mexico, Arizona area? Yeah, they used to be in Texas, and they ran for their lives from the Comanches. The Comanches were beasts. And you did not want to get caught by the Comanches, let me tell you what. And they didn't. Hugh and his buddy, woo, we made it past the Comanches. We're good to go. We're in Kansas now, baby. Except the Pawnee Indians captured them. Now, when the Pawnee Indians captured them, this is how we began our story. But, oh, man, are we not even close to the end of our story. This is when the Pawnees shot those little pine slivers into Hugh's buddy, lit him up like a torch, and then approached Hugh because he was next. Well, Hugh Glass was cool as a cucumber. He produced this powder that he had stolen from the pirates, totally straight-faced, and offered it to the chief as a gift. The chief looks down at this powder, looks up at Hugh. Hang on, I'll tell you what happens next.
Talk Radio Revolution, Jesse Kelly.
Village chief looks down at Hugh Glass's offer and he says to himself, you know what? This guy's just all right. They cut Hugh Glass loose from his pole and basically adopt him. He took to Indian life very well. Again, this is a man who, think about the life he's lived so far. This is a man who lives a life of adventure. And the Pawnee took him in and showed him how to survive in the wild. They showed him how to hunt. They showed him how to fish. They showed him how to use a tomahawk. They showed him how to use a knife. Taught him how to use a weapon. We're talking a four-year immersion in the ways of the Pawnee. Would serve him very, very well in the days to come. Eventually, Hugh decides he's going to leave because this is clearly a man who can't sit still. And he finds out the Ashley Henry Fur Company is putting together an expedition. Let me explain something about fur companies before I go any further. It's very difficult for us to understand how gigantic and lucrative the fur industry was back in the day. Here's the best way I can describe it. Think about it like oil today. Let's say you're a young, adventurous man. And you find out in Siberia, there are some extremely, extremely rich oil wells up there. You just have to get there. And if you manage to get there, and you certainly might die, but if you manage to get there, you can go from being a young, poor, adventurous young man to being a young, adventurous, very, very wealthy young man. These furs were nothing like you can think of now, and they shipped them around the world, especially beaver pelts, but all furs. I mean, everybody wanted them. You know, I realize there's a whole animal rights component to that, but the truth is, what's better than animal fur? As far as a design goes for something that is waterproof and warm, God hasn't been topped. So if you're looking for something like that, yes, picking something he designed over something Hugo Boss designed is probably a very good idea. Well, that was another era. But be that as it may, just know that whole fur companies started specifically to trap and get these furs, and it was big money. Big money, like a gold rush type thing. So the Ashley Henry Fur Company puts together an expedition. Now, remember the era we're in here. Again, it's hard for us to wrap our minds around this. This expedition is leaving the Missouri area, the Kansas, Missouri, that area, which is about as far west as civilization went. I need to stress that point. Yes, there were forts and things out west by this point, but it is wild. There aren't massive booming cities. This is even before the 1849 gold rush. I mean, there are people, but there aren't many of them. You're taking off up the Missouri River, heading towards the Dakotas, heading towards Montana. You are essentially, back in this day, heading towards the moon. You are hopping on a boat, heading into the Amazon. You are heading into the unknown. So a group of young men, a bunch of trappers and fighters, sign on to the Ashley Henry Fur Company, and they're heading to Montana for pelts. A 1,500-mile trip. And at one point in time, as they're making their way towards it, they come across some Arikara Indians. Now, I'm going to call them Ree Indians because that's what they called them. They called them Rees. They're Arikaras, but they call them Rees. And they sit down and they have a very cordial conversation with these Indians. They get some guidance here, guidance there, and they trade. You know, hey, we have some gunpowder for you here, and you have this for us. And it was a very cordial relationship until that night when the storms came and the Rees double-crossed them and tracked them down and killed almost all of them. The fur trappers. Of course, they did not kill Mr. Hugh Glass. He and about 10 to a dozen men, we don't know exactly, managed to make it out of there alive. Only they're still, one, wounded, and two, being hunted by these Rees. These Rees were warlike people, did not want the white men there catching furs. So they hunker down for a while. They recover, and then they have to figure out, okay, well, we have to get out of here. We are in the middle of absolutely nowhere, and there's a fort up on the Yellowstone. It's about 300 miles away. We can't risk a boat. We don't even have one anymore anyway. Even if we could build one, we have to go on foot. And so these mountain men, they called them old coons. That's what they called each other. These old coons begin to make their way through the wilderness, being hunted down by Indians who want scalps. Again, this is not something in the movies, although they made a movie about this whole story. This is reality. And here's the issue when you're men traveling that way on foot, no horses, no boats, and being hunted down by Indians. You have to eat. Food doesn't miraculously come down from the heavens unless you're the Israelites who just escaped Egypt. You have to eat. And you need to shoot your weapon to eat. And Indians have ears too. So they had to be very, very careful how much they shot their weapons, how much they ate. Nevertheless, it had to happen. You have to walk 300 miles. So Hugh sets out. They would set aside two or three men at a time to go out on a hunt. And Hugh sets out because he was, of course, one of the better ones on a hunt. Starts looking around for food. Comes across, well, the worst thing you can ever come across in the wilderness. Now, let me step aside for a moment and explain. You see, Hugh Glass came across baby bear cubs, grizzly bear cubs. I grew up in Montana. I moved there when I was 10. And you just learn different ways to survive. You learn different things when you're up there. You just have to grow up in different ways. And one thing you know, whether it be black bear or grizzly bear, whatever it is, if you ever, ever come across bear cubs, if you even see them a mile away, you turn around and you sprint in the opposite direction. Because bear, mama bears, do not mess around. You don't have to be playing with them. You don't have to be shooting them, stabbing them, harassing them, feeding them berries. If a mama bear sees you anywhere near her bear cubs, She is going to rip your face off. That's how bear are. Especially grizzlies, but black bear are the same way. Black bear kill people for the same reasons. All those bear attacks you hear about up in Montana, and they have them every year, people die from them. They're all, pretty much all of them, 99.9% are female grizzly bears who had cubs with them. And here's the problem. You don't know. What if the cubs are sitting there quiet, which they often are, and you come across them? You don't know. These hikers don't know. And Hugh Glass was as experienced as anyone alive in the wilderness. He didn't know. Come through a grove of trees, and he's staring at some bear cubs. He's smart enough to know this is not a good situation. Begins to back away. Oh, but Mama Grizzly already smelled him. You see, bear have the best noses that I know of on the planet. You know, bloodhounds, how amazing bloodhounds are at smelling. Bear, I forget what the number is, are several times. It's something like 100 or 200 times greater their noses are than bloodhounds. That's why bear spray actually works. Their noses are so incredibly sensitive. She smelled Hugh Glass, saw Hugh Glass. She charged Hugh Glass. Now, Hugh, again, cool as a cucumber, levels his rifle, fires his one shot, and it didn't work. Hit that grizzly bear with that one shot he had in his musket, but it is a grizzly bear, and understand this. This can be difficult for people who don't understand how big and massively powerful grizzly bears are. For one, if you were to hold up the paw of a grizzly bear, it is easily the size of your head. Easily. They're horrifying. Go ahead and Google the image. I love them. That bear, they're fascinating creatures. I have seen video, not heard stories, I've seen video before of a grizzly bear taking down a 2,000-pound moose, carrying it in its mouth, and the ease with which the bear is ragdolling this 2,000-pound moose is, it was something to watch. It might have been 1,500, but it was a big, big animal, and it looked like your dog with a little squeaky toy in its mouth. They're just big, and they're pure muscle. Lewis and Clark actually wrote about this when they did their famous expedition out west, because they obviously had muskets as well, and they had never seen these before. This was the expedition where they were going out to see what's out here. For all we know, there are aliens out west. And they went, and you can still read it in their journals. They talked about these grizzly bear, and they thought that they were monsters. They would shoot them 7 or 8 times with those old muskets, and the bear would not die. To this day, you know, that weapon you use as a personal carry weapon, I mean, my personal carry weapon is a 9mm. You might as well just throw the gun at the bear. I'm not exaggerating. A 9mm will not even penetrate a bear's skull. It certainly will not stop a charging one. I have rounds in my 9mm that'll make your heart explode. It will not even slow down a grizzly bear. You take a .44 Magnum and bear spray when you're in bear country. So obviously an old musket and ball, even a big one like the one Hugh Glass had. He has a special rifle. He loved it. Even that did not do the trick. She got to him, and she ripped him to shreds. Her claws, you can imagine a bear's claws if you've never seen them. At one point in time, she raked the claws across the front of his throat, doing a lot of damage. She ripped his face to shreds. She tore into his leg and broke it. She bit his arm. As you can imagine, he was trying to defend himself from having his face ripped off anymore. At one point, as a defense mechanism, this is just human nature, he rolls over trying to make it stop, at which point a bear just starts tearing into your back. A lot of grizzly attacks end this way. It starts ripping open his back. The attack ends, and you can actually, by all accounts, see his ribs through his back. His throat, which got the claws across them, he was gurgling. You could hear it. He was barely alive, barely conscious. Now you have an issue, don't you? Because here you are being hunted down by Indians in the middle of the wilderness, and you have an injured man, and by all accounts, a dying man. Now, to the credit of the men who were with him, when they found him, they didn't leave him there, they didn't shoot him, they made for him, you know, a litter to carry him with, and they carried him for 2 or 3 days. There are conflicting reports on how long they carried him, but here's the truth. These men were scared to death. The Indians were still coming. They knew they were coming. The Indians were just looking for them. As soon as they found them, they were all going to die. You can't carry a man through terrain like that with any kind of speed, certainly not the kind of speed these men would have been moving at otherwise. You have to stop. You have to give him water. You have to care for him. And he's in and out of consciousness. He's not speaking. He can't speak. He doesn't have a throat. And so the leader of this group, Henry, remember, this was the Ashley Henry Fur Company, and Henry has to make a very, very difficult decision. And he decides he needs 2 men to stay with Hugh while Hugh dies so they can give him a proper burial after he dies. Now, as you may imagine, there weren't a ton of hands going up when he asked for volunteers to stay in Indian country with the dying man and possibly have your scalp carved off the top of your head while you're still alive. So he had to throw in a little extra cheddar cheese in the deal, and I believe it was 7 months. He promised whoever stayed back an extra 7 months' wages. He finally got 2 volunteers, a Mr. John Fitzgerald and a kid, I believe he was 19 at the time, Jim Bridger. That is very much a kid. Hugh Glass was 40 at this point. Now, Hugh was old for a mountain man, but 19 is a puppy. You haven't even lived life yet. That's awfully young. John Fitzgerald and Jim Bridger agree to stay back. And they stay with him for a day. He doesn't die. And they stay with him for another day. And he doesn't die. And this guy's not dying. And we need to get out of here before we all die. And John Fitzgerald and Jim Bridger are figuring out what to do. They're shooing the flies away from him as best they can. They're right by a little stream. They're giving him as much cool water as they can, but that's not doing much of anything. And finally, mercifully, he breaks out into a horrible fever. And Fitzgerald says, yes, he's about to die. This is it. He's got the death sweats, they called it. And he doesn't die. And now they don't know what to do. We can't stay here. We're just 2 men. We can't fight off a whole group of angry re-Indians. We're all going to die. What are we going to do? We can't leave him. And they make a decision. John Fitzgerald was apparently the leader. He was the more experienced. He was the older one. Jim Bridger, according to Jim Bridger and others, was very uncomfortable with this, but they begin having this conversation right in front of Hugh Glass. Unbeknownst to them, Hugh Glass couldn't speak, didn't have his eyes open, but could hear every single word as they sat there beside him and discussed, well, let's leave him and we'll just tell everyone he's dead. Now, you can't show back up to the group if you're John Fitzgerald and Jim Bridger empty-handed. They're going to be like, wait, what? Are you sure he died? So, I mean, you can't leave valuables out in the wilderness, rifles and things. So not only did they leave him laying there, they took his musket, they took his powder, they took the shot that goes with it. They took his tomahawk. They took his flint. They took his knife. They took everything of value off his person, threw a buffalo blanket on him, and walked away. Only Hugh Glass wasn't dead yet. And Hugh Glass was not a man who wanted to die. There he is laying by a stream with a buffalo blanket on, one broken leg, only one arm of any use. Looks up and sees some buffalo berries there. Now he has a throat that is no longer there. So he has to use the stream water and smash the buffalo berries up with the stream water and gut things down with his ripped open throat to get some nourishment inside of him. A day or two of this, and he sees a rattlesnake coming his way. You would be petrified. You're not Hugh Glass. Neither am I. Hugh Glass kills the rattlesnake with his one good arm with a rock he had there. Manages to smash enough of the rattlesnake meat up that he can gut it down as well on his damaged throat. And now Hugh Glass only wants one thing in the world, and no, it's not to live. He wants to go kill John Fitzgerald and Jim Bridger. That's all he wants in life. So he rolls over on his belly and starts to crawl. Glass, 250 miles away from the nearest fort, begins to crawl with one broken leg, which he had to set himself, obviously with no anesthesia, and one good arm. He crawls. Now, this is a man severely wounded, still fighting fever, one arm and one leg. So when I say it was slow going, I mean slow going. Eventually, his arm and leg would just give out, and he would have to lay there for a day, work up his strength again, and continue to crawl on. Hugh has a bigger problem, though. Infection. Now, the front of him miraculously was okay, but remember, he was laying on his back by that stream, and his back was shredded by that grizzly bear with deep, deep, deep lacerations, and infection's coming, and he can smell it, and he can feel it, and infection's going to kill him quickly. So he finds maggots. Maggots, while this is not the most pleasant thought in the world, eat away dead flesh. Dead flesh is where the bacteria grows, and he puts maggots into his own wounds in his back to eat out the infection. And he continues to crawl. He comes across a freshly killed buffalo carcass, but the problem is it's freshly killed by the wolves that are surrounding the buffalo carcass, but you are not some dainty little flower. You are Hugh freaking Glass. So what's he do? He starts a fire. Somehow, someone's going to have to explain to me how he managed to start a fire with nothing else. Manages to chase the wolves away from the dead buffalo with the fire and breaks off the bones that he can and sucks the marrow out of the buffalo, which probably tasted like heaven for one, and two, is absolutely nutrient rich. And he keeps crawling. And then Indians find him. But fear not. These are not the Ree who found him. These were actually Sioux. Now, the American people went to war with the Sioux people several times at several different places throughout our history. I mean, the Battle of Little Bighorn, who do you think we were fighting there? General Custer, all that stuff. Chris, does that ring any bells to you? All right. However, these Sioux, for whatever reason, took pity on him, packed him up, picked him up, and took off for Fort Kiowa, where he thought Jim Bridger and John Fitzgerald were going to be. The Sioux finally get him there, and neither of those guys are there. They've already taken off. Okay, that's fine. You're still Hugh Glass. You're not exactly one to lay down and take it. So what's he do? He has nothing. He signs on with a new fur company because they promised to give him a rifle and equipment and everything if he'll sign on and do some trapping for them and also take him to where he can go kill the two guys. He takes off with this fur company. They go in and sit down with some unknown Indians. They didn't know who they were at the time. It occurs to Hugh Glass halfway through the meeting, uh-oh, these are actually re-Indians. And the Indians attacked and killed everybody Hugh was with, except for Hugh managed to escape again. Barely. Now, he finally makes his way to a new fort. He finds Jim Bridger. Remember the kid? Jim Bridger was broken, felt horribly guilty, begged Hugh's forgiveness. Remember, Hugh got to hear the whole conversation and realized this was just a young, dumb kid, didn't know what he was doing. Hugh forgives him. To this day, actually, I grew up in Bozeman, Montana. The major mountain range, one of them that's right beside Bozeman, is the Bridger Mountains. Jim Bridger went on to have a famous, famous mountain man career after this. Maybe the most famous mountain man ever. But Hugh Glass still wants to kill John Fitzgerald. So he takes off again, heading towards the fort where he hears John Fitzgerald is. And he gets attacked by Indians again. And this time, he actually loses the brand new rifle that he had gotten. Only he's alone in the wilderness again. But this time, he has a tomahawk, he has a knife, he has a flint. And by his own account, he said, look, compared to last time, I thought I was living well. Yeah, I don't have a rifle, but I'm living high on hog here. And tell me if this isn't one of the coolest parts of the story. He survives, he says, with relative ease, making his way to the other fort, killing baby buffalo with a knife and eating them along the way. What a beast. What an absolute stud. How does that even work? Eventually, though, he finally walks into a fort, and before him stands Mr. John Fitzgerald, who left him to die, took his rifle, which he still had, and everything else. Hang on. Most you've ever hated anybody in your life? Hopefully not too much, right? We don't need to be full of bitterness. But try to wrap your mind around how much Hugh Glass hated John Fitzgerald at this very moment. And not just this moment. Imagine when your leg is broken and your body's ripped to shreds and you have one good arm as well, and you're crawling with your face in the dirt, eating roots and things. How much would John Fitzgerald be on your mind with every single crawl? With every single minute of the day passing by? You'd hate him. And according to Hugh, that was what got him through. Isn't that amazing? It wasn't some will to live. All he wanted to do in life from that point on was kill John Fitzgerald for what he did for him. That's kind of sweet, right? That's all he wanted to do in life was kill John Fitzgerald. So he finally makes his way into the fort. And there's John Fitzgerald with Hugh Glass's rifle, which he loves. Hang on.
Jesse Kelly Show. This is the Jesse Kelly Show.
Hugh Glass walks into that fort, and let me just totally buzzkill you on, well, not the end, but how that worked out. Turns out John Fitzgerald had joined the freaking army. And Hugh Glass cannot walk into an army fort and shoot someone in the army, or Hugh Glass is going to be killed. They did understand his story. They gave Hugh Glass his rifle back. Hugh Glass finished the encounter simply telling John Fitzgerald, "Don't ever leave the army or I'm going to kill you." And he walked away. And you may call this tragic. I call this beautiful in its own way. Hugh Glass went on to be exactly what you think he would be. An extreme loner. He would ride off into the wild wilderness all by himself and come back with just a pile of furs. He never stopped. He never slowed down. Finally, at the age of 50, he was walking along the frozen Yellowstone River with two trapper friends of his. And lo and behold, those re-Indians finally got a hold of him. Killed him and his two friends, scalped him, and were last seen riding off with that famous rifle Hugh had to track down all those years before. And the question is, and we've had this talk before on the show, but it's time to have a very frank talk about it. What do you think about Hugh Glass's life? You undoubtedly admire it. You like hearing about it. Who doesn't? Who wouldn't like hearing about something that's awesome? Do you want that to be your life? That's really what it comes down to, right? The guy has a big plaque where he was attacked by that grizzly bear. I believe it's in South Dakota. You can go see it to this day. Do you want that life? He was born in Scranton, Pennsylvania. What if he grew up in Scranton and never went down to become a pirate? Never escaped various Indians, never saw his buddy burned alive, never got attacked by a grizzly bear, never ended up getting killed and scalped. What if he grew up in Scranton, Pennsylvania? Just had a nice, safe life, right? It's Scranton, Pennsylvania. Open up a little candy shop down the road. Get yourself a little wife. Crank out a few kids. Make a little money, spend a little money, build yourself a nice little house, die at the ripe old age of 80 in your bed in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Is that a better life than the one he had? We all have to ask ourselves this question, especially now. And I'm asking you this for this reason. I am not trying to be a downer. I am telling you we are heading into an era that is different than any era you and I have ever known. Virus, economic dislocation like you cannot possibly imagine. What if there's no Disney World in a couple months? What if cruise ships virtually go away? What if air travel completely changes? Hotels? Concerts? When's the next time you think you're going to go to a concert? What if, hear me out, what if we have 10, 15, 20% contraction of the U.S. economy. Think about this. Now, that's a complicated thing. You may not know what I mean, so think about it this way. Think about 10 stores that you frequent. Restaurants, hardware, whatever it may be. Now imagine 3 or 4 of those disappearing. Think about your neighbors. Think about 10 of your neighbors. Think about 2 or 3 of them foreclosing on their home and being gone in a month or two. If we are really heading into these hard times we are possibly heading into, if we are, we are going to talk through it. We're going to laugh on this show. We're going to go over the headlines. We're going to, I'll tell you my take on things. But don't lose sight of this. You can call me crazy all you want. We've talked about it before. Isn't that, in its own way, kind of cool? Yes, suffering, disaster. I understand it. But you can sit around and lick your wounds and wallow in your sorrow. And it's always fine to take a little time to mourn every now and then. I'm not telling you, hey, people are dying and the economy's destroyed. But at some point, you are going to die, right? Do you think Hugh Glass had an amazing life, or a horrible life? Let me ask you this. Would you ever have heard his name had he been a little candy shop owner in Scranton, Pennsylvania? You never would have known that man existed. You never would have known his stories. You never would have known his quotes. You never would have known his friends. You never would have known he existed. That man has been in the ground for a long, long, long time. And I just told his story to the nation of the United States of America. They made a movie about it. They took a lot of liberties with the story, which I didn't think they needed to take. Leonardo DiCaprio was in it. It was called The Revenant, but it was an awesome, awesome movie that really did drive home some of these things and allowed you to visualize it. So go rent The Revenant today. You will enjoy it. Or maybe it's free on Netflix or Prime or something if you're dead broke like most of us are. Go watch it. That's his story. They don't make a movie about Hugh Glass, the candy shop owner who died safely and calmly in his bed at 80. Did he experience a world of pain and suffering in his life? You bet he did. More than I ever want to experience. But talk about dying with some stories. Talk about a life to remember. And what if that's what we're facing right now? Something different than anybody you've ever known in your life alive today has experienced. Isn't that in its own way kind of cool? I say it is. Now you can say I'm just putting a rosy spin on things, and maybe that's true. Some of that probably is true. I will tell you, one of the things we did often in the Marine Corps, when things were really ugly and dark and miserable, one of the things we did often, and people who were watching us, if they were from on the outside, would have thought we were nuts, we would laugh. We would tell the sickest, darkest jokes you could possibly imagine. We would be stuck in a horrible, miserable, dangerous situation. And we would just look at each other, and we would just start laughing hysterically. I don't mean a little giggle, because what else can you do? We'll roll with the punches. We'll take it as it comes. You can disagree all you want. You're welcome to email me, jesse@jessekellyshow.com. jesse@jessekellyshow.com. I say dying with grizzly bear wounds and no scalp on your head at 50. I say that's a cool life.
The Jesse Kelly Show.
Your holster is way more important than you think it is. It's just way more important than you think it is. Look, and I get that. The holster's not the sexy part of carrying firearms, right? You want to talk about your weapon and your ammunition. You want to talk about your safety training. You want to talk about how you did at the range. Oh, look at my groups. I was doing these failure drills today. And all that stuff's really important. I mean, really, really important. I'm not discounting that. But I've known so many people who do all those things. They take all the necessary steps, and then they carry with a holster they bought from a big box hunting store that was made 1,000 at a time. Please, don't put your life in one of those holsters. You need to trust Northwest Retention Systems because it's all custom-made gear. It's the only thing I carry around. NWRetention.com. That's NWRetention.com. Use the promo code Jesse. Get you 10% off.
The Medal of Honor is the highest military decoration in the United States. Recipients have done the improbable, the unexpected, showing immense bravery and sacrifice in the name of something much bigger than themselves.
This medal is for the man who went down that day.
On Medal of Honor, Stories of Courage, you'll hear about these heroes and what their stories tell us about the nature of bravery. Listen to Medal of Honor on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is an iHeart podcast.